He says secession is revolution. There's no constitutional mechanism for secession. Secession simply is outright revolution. It's a radical break with the Constitution. And it's going to be followed, he says, by war, and can't be otherwise. So even Robert E. Lee was not under any illusions that somehow what the Confederacy was doing was something that the founders would have sanctioned in the Constitution. The United States never was some kind of voluntary federation of states like the UN.
History isn't just a bunch of names and dates and facts. It's the collection of all the stories throughout human history that explain how and why we got here. Welcome to the History Unplugged podcast, where we look at the forgotten, neglected, strange, and even counterfactual stories that made our world what it is. I'm your host, Scott Rank. For somebody who was born 200 years ago, Robert E. Lee is in the news quite a bit. In 2017, there was deadly violence that erupted around the Robert E. Lee Monument in Charlottesville, Virginia, over a protest on removing that monument. In Richmond, Virginia, the former capital of the Confederacy, another statue of his was taken down at the historic Monument Avenue. Now, opponents of Lee will say that, number one, the statues came up not immediately after his life, but during the period of Jim Crow law, and they're more of a symbol of the South embracing its heritage, much of which is racist. Whereas his supporters will say that Lee was the embodiment of Southern chivalry and almost a part of the American aristocracy. And due to his diplomacy and efforts to try to reunite the North and the South after the war, allowed for healing to begin over the generations ahead and not have some sort of permanent armistice between the two parts of the nation. Well, Lee is still one of the most confounding figures in American history. Today's guest, Ellen Guelzo, is author of the book Robert E. Lee, A Life, who describes a Virginian from his refined upbringing in Virginia high society to his long career in the U.S. Army, his decision to side with Virginia when it seceded from the Union, and his leadership during the Civil War. So I hope you enjoyed this discussion with Ellen Guelzo. Ellen, welcome to the show.
Thank you very much, Scott. It's good to be talking to you today.
We'll be looking at a figure who has appeared many times on this podcast in the 20-plus episode series I did with co-host James Early on key battles of the Civil War. I've compared Ulysses S. Grant with Robert E. Lee as military leaders and strategists and tacticians, but never specifically Lee as the hero of his own story. So we have a lot to unpack here, and there's a lot of scholarship on Lee. There's a lot of different camps on perspectives of him on a multitude of issues, but I want to start with something that's contemporary in the news. And in the last few years, with the vociferous public debate about public statues, namely Confederate statues, there have been a number that have been taken down. Or most notably, I think, is the recent one in Richmond, a capital of the Virginia and the former Confederacy, where a statue of Lee was taken down at Monument Avenue. So detractors would say, well, it's not really about Lee. It's that this is a symbol of all the Confederate iconography that really sprouted up in the era of Jim Crow. So it's pushing back against that, not so much the man, although led the Confederacy. Whereas sympathizers would say, yes, he led the Confederacy, but he really is imbued with the greatest of sort of our history of chivalry. And because of his efforts at reconciliation after the war, he could have very well thwarted the possibility of a multi-decade low-level guerrilla warfare that was taking place between the Confederacy, the former Confederacy, and the Union. So to begin with that, what is your take on it, to just jump into the hot button issue first?
Well, today I actually get more questions about statues of Lee than Lee himself. So it's not a surprise that that's what we begin with. And I have to admit that I am at sixes and sevens about the removal of the Lee statue in Richmond and the other Lee statues that have been removed in New Orleans, in Charlottesville, in Dallas, and some other places. Scott, on the one hand, I'm a Yankee from Yankee land. Now, some people have said, well, that immediately disqualifies you to write about Robert E. Lee. So, of course, my feeling is, no, actually, I think that gives me a perspective that is less heavily influenced and wrapped around regional identities. But as a Yankee, I do have to admit, I cannot fathom why you put up statues to people who committed treason. And I have the same problem with people who wave the Confederate flag. I don't use the word treason lightly. I'm not throwing that around carelessly. My father was a career military officer, U.S. Army. My son is U.S. Army. That's a word with some very specific meaning. I think, though, that many people look at Lee and they fail to take into account the fact that the man raised his hand against the nation that he had sworn an oath to uphold. When he was commissioned in 1829, the oath he took was to the United States. And my father took that oath, my son took that oath. I took that oath when I became a member of the National Council for the Humanities. And that's all of that's not helped by the fact that the cause that Lee and the other Confederates fought for was wrapped around a defense of human slavery and human trafficking. Not to say Jim Crow. So the question that usually comes to my mind is, why should the artifacts of that cause, be they statues or whatever, have been in any other place but a museum? If somebody wanted to propose erecting a statue to Robert E. Lee today, and they came to me and said, would you sign our petition for this? I would tell them as politely as I could to get lost. Now, it is true that Lee in the post-war years does establish a track record about reconciliation. It is true that by surrendering the Army of Northern Virginia at Appomattox and surrendering it as an army, he very consciously and very deliberately short-circuited any resort by the Confederacy to long-term guerrilla warfare. And that could very easily have taken place. There is a cognate to this situation in the Russian experience in the middle of the 19th century as the Russians attempted to subdue the Caucasus. That was where the Imam Shamil carried on really a 30-year guerrilla warfare against the Imperial Russian Army. We know something about this because that's where Tolstoy served as a junior officer, and he wrote stories about that. So that some of that is still alive in our in literary memory. But that kind of experience was really horrendous. That could easily have been transferred by Lee to the American scene. And just imagine the entire Appalachian and Trans-Appalachian region being turned into a theater of guerrilla warfare. That could have happened. And who knows how long that would have gone on and what the long-term results would have been for the country as a whole. And yet, even there, the kind of reconciliation Lee promoted was comparatively muted. He opposed, curiously enough, the idea of putting up statues. He resisted. People made the offer to him. Oh, should we put up a memorial? Should we put up a monument to Confederate veterans, even to Robert E. Lee? And he resists that. But he does not do more than that. He is not a friend to Reconstruction and post-war Reconstruction policies. He's not an avowed enemy. He's just not much of a friend to them. So the reconciliation part only goes really so far. And as for guerrilla warfare, all right, it's true. He didn't sanction outright guerrilla warfare. He did not, certainly did not sanction armed, violent resistance to Reconstruction. And yet Reconstruction is itself pockmarked and to a certain degree subverted by what almost comes up to a kind of guerrilla warfare if you look at the kind of civil strife that plagued the Reconstruction years from 1865 to 1877. So there are points in which you can insist that Robert E. Lee did at least some things that put him on the side of the angels, but even there, there are qualifications. So I have some problems on the one hand with statues to Robert E. Lee. The thing is, that's not the whole story. The Lee Monument in Richmond, for instance, dates from the 1890s. And I'm sure that in the 1890s, there was a message about white supremacy there. But there were also messages, other kinds of messages. These statues are being put up in the 1890s because nobody in the South could afford to put them up in the 1860s and the 1870s. The South had almost literally been destroyed. So no one's going to do that. It's not until the South begins to experience some kind of economic recovery that enough of these Confederate veterans have enough in the way of resources that they can put up statues. And when they put up statues, what are they really remembering? Well, yeah, part of it is about the justice of their lost cause. That's the assertion they're making. Part of it is about sending a message about who's in charge in the South, which is to say white people. But another part of it is surely a kind of nostalgia as people move into middle age and beyond, they're looking back at this great event of their youth. And they want to remember that. They want some kind of memorialization of it. So that's also a factor that goes into the making of these statues, and especially a Lee statue. But I think there's one big thing that's often missed when we try to understand statues of Robert E. Lee or statues about Confederates, and that's this. In American culture, we worship success. If you're successful, that's supposed to mean you're good. If you lose, it's supposed to mean you're worthless. It's like Vince Lombardi, winning is not just the most important thing, winning is the only thing. And Leo Durocher, I think it was Leo Durocher, saying, nice guys finish last. Yeah, he was putting people down that way. Lee symbolized something very different. Lee symbolized the possibility of maintaining a sense of dignity in the face of defeat. He symbolized the possibility that the winners were not necessarily the good, and the people who wind up paying for their deeds are not necessarily bad. That message is wrapped up in the Lee statues too. That may be a message we regret losing in a dog-eat-dog kind of world. There's one more factor too, Scott, and that is that monuments like the Lee statue change. And when I say that, people crinkle their noses up because they say, how can a statue change? I mean, it's made of granite or it's made of bronze. Well, what I mean by that is when statues like the Lee statue in Richmond are put up, they serve as memorials. And here's where the white supremacy messages get attached. The statues are put up to remind people of what the Confederacy was and what it was about. But over time, as generations pass, the perceptions of the statues change. They begin as memorials, but as the generations pass, they decline into something else. They decline into monuments. The Lee statue became a remembrance of a chapter in Richmond's history, the Civil War. And then more generations pass, and the monument declines still further into being really simply a marker. And people are driving down Monument Avenue, and they're going around the circle. And even if they think about it, what they think about it is, oh, yeah, that's Robert E. Lee, some history dude. And you see this happen in a lot of other monuments and memorials and markers. Out in California, there is a park, a memorial park for the Donner Party. You know, the Donner Party was this group of Westering pioneers who get caught in the Rockies in the winter, and the snow comes down, and what are they end up cannibalizing each other.
Yeah, so what are we celebrating here?
Yeah. So there's Donner Park there, and there's a statue memorializing the Donner Party. And believe it or not, it's right next to a picnic area. So you can have a barbecue there in Donner Park. Well, do people look at that today and do they say, oh my goodness, that's an incitement to cannibalism? No. I mean, the thing happened. The event happened so long ago. It's so beyond the reach of people today that, you know, no one thinks in those terms. The Whiskey Rebellion in Western Pennsylvania in the 1790s. The Whiskey Rebellion was an insurrection. It was an act of treason. There is a monument to the Whiskey Rebels in Washington County. Do people walk past that and, you know, hit their foreheads with the palm of their hands and saying, oh my goodness, they're honoring and encouraging treason? No, because these monuments, memorials, markers, they've changed over time. The immediate message that might have been attached to them has long since been leached away. And I think in many respects that has happened to Lee statues and to Confederate monuments. So as a historian, I'm always reluctant to see monuments and memorials destroyed. I mean, we lose something. They're part of our historical memory. And you just can't jettison pieces of that memory and still hold on to the substance of it. On the other hand, I am a citizen of a democracy. And if the citizens of Richmond determine that there's a monument they want to remove, I have no legitimate reason for standing in the path of that decision. What I hope for is that decisions like this about statues and monuments are made reasonably, as the product of a process, not by impulse or by ignorance or by rage. You know, it's often said that things like ignorance and impulse and rage, those are the unfortunate necessities you've got to live with in a democracy, because a democracy teems with them. Well, I hope that the voices that say so are wrong. And maybe the way in which we deal with our monuments, not just Lee, but all historical memoranda, maybe the way we deal with our monuments can be seen as the measure of how seriously we take not just our history, but how seriously we take the process of democracy.
Hey everyone, Scott here. We're going to take a very short break for a word from our sponsors. Well, that's a very well-rounded answer. It's a question that I've come to in different ways on this podcast of what is the division line between a revolution against a tyrannical force, and this gets right into the language used during the Revolutionary War, versus treason against a government, versus what we celebrate today of civil disobedience, the civil rights movement, and things like that, and highlighting law and a codified process that discriminated against a certain group. So that really adds a lot to that question. Now, you mentioned a few things in your answer, and that something else you note in your book is that Lee wasn't an intellectual. He didn't leave behind writings that we go back to today. We have his actions, but in many ways, he's more of a symbol that we impute values into. And that's part of why he's become the myth of the lost cause. And the historiography of the Civil War and the immediate history of the Civil War written after the war itself by Southerners has had an incredibly long radioactive half-life that it still influences things today, such as, like I mentioned, Lee being a tactical and strategic military genius, and that's part of the mythology too. So there's an element of deconstruction, of course, that always has to go into this. Without hitting point by point all the aspects of his life, could you just provide us what you think are the salient points of Lee's life, whether his education or his military career, that you think are important for us to be aware of to just, as you discuss, the main points of your book?
Actually, I think the most significant moment to take into account for understanding Robert E. Lee occurs before any of those things, before he goes to West Point, before he becomes an officer in the Corps of Engineers, before the Civil War. I think the salient experience of his life is a traumatic one that occurs when he's 7 years old, and that's when his father leaves. His father was Light Horse Harry, famous hero of the American Revolution, talented light cavalry commander, one of that circle of young men whom George Washington drew around him as surrogate sons, people like Alexander Hamilton and John Lawrence and the Marquis de Lafayette. Harry Lee was part of that circle. But unlike those others, Harry Lee, once the revolution was over and the fighting was over, demonstrated an unfortunate talent for putting his foot down on the wrong side of nearly everything. Washington encouraged his surrogate sons to invest in land in the West. Well, that's what Light Horse Harry did. And he burned through all of his first wife's cash, remarried, and started burning through his second wife's cash, putting money into land investments that he thought were going to turn into great development opportunities, but instead turned into colossal losses. I mean, he had an instinct. It was almost like the Midas touch in reverse. Everything turned to lead. If Light Horse Harry Lee was living today, he'd be investing in ski resorts in Bangladesh. So when you look at Light Horse Harry, it's one well-meaning failure and blunder after another, culminating in the fact that, politically speaking, as a Federalist, he is a critic of Thomas Jefferson. That wipes him out politically in Virginia. But as a Federalist, he goes to Baltimore in 1813 after the outbreak of the War of 1812 to support people who are critical of the war, and gets beaten by a Jeffersonian mob within an inch of his life. After that, with his creditors pounding on the doors, badly injured from this, he simply leaves. He leaves for the West Indies. And he never comes back to see Robert or the rest of his family. He does make it back to the United States in 1818, but that's only 2 weeks before he dies. He's dying of cancer when he comes back. He makes landfall. He survives for only those 2 weeks and is buried in Georgia. That means that Robert E. Lee experiences what Leon Edel once called the most severe trauma someone can experience, and that is the loss of a parent before the onset of adolescence. When you're psychologically, you're simply incapable of understanding or coping with it. And the shadow that Light Horse Harry and his disappearance throw over Robert is, I think, substantial. And I think it generates three character developments in Robert E. Lee that stay with him all his life, and I think go a long way to explaining large parts of that life. One is, it turns Robert E. Lee into a perfectionist. He is going to redeem his father's imperfections. He is going to wipe out the blots on the name of Lee. And he'll do it single-handedly if he has to, but he's going to do it. And that passion for perfectionism shows up all his life. It makes him very diligent, very precise. It also makes him very demanding, sometimes almost to the point of nastiness, in dealing with subordinates, with dealing with other people. Walter Taylor, who served as his adjutant during the Civil War in the Army of Northern Virginia, greatly admired his boss, but at the same time wrote to his fiancée that General Lee could be downright at various moments. So demanding, so unappreciative. These are the kinds of things that Taylor says about him. Well, that's not because Lee was necessarily trying to work hard at being a terrible person. No, it was his instinct for perfection. He simply demanded it of himself and demanded it of others. Two other things that this experience generates in Lee is a passion for independence. He wants to stand on his own. He wants to be understood on his own. When he's growing up, right up until the outbreak of the Civil War, people are forever introducing him as the son of Light Horse Harry Lee, without anyone having so much as a glimpse of what must have been going through Robert E. Lee's mind when they were doing so. So he wants to stand on his own, and he wants to chart his own path. Along with that, he wants security, because one thing the departure of his father clearly deprived him of was security. He spends the rest of his life pursuing security. This is why he stays in the Army as long as he does. It's not because the Army is providing him with lightning promotion. It's not because the Army is providing him with baskets of recognition. And it's certainly not because service in the Army is overly lucrative. What it is reliable. And that security is what he craves. So he is pursuing these three goals through his life. And much of Robert E. Lee's behavior as soldier, as husband, as father, and in the last 5 years of his life as the president of Washington College really needs to be seen through the lens of those three aspects of his character.
That's very interesting. It's not a part of his character that I considered, although I did have an episode, interestingly enough, that listeners can hear on Light Horse Harry Lee, which, if nothing else, gave a great eulogy to George Washington. So he's
right.
What's the phrase? The
first in war, first in peace, first in the hearts of his countrymen.
There you are.
I mean, one thing that Light Horse Harry Lee was good at was words. He was a wonderful speaker, a wonderful rhetorician. He earned recognition for that as an undergraduate at Princeton before the Revolution. He was a wonderful wordsmith. But could he make those words sprout legs and actually do things? No. That sometimes is the tragedy of people who are very good with words. Look at Plutarch's joint biography of Demosthenes and Cicero. Both of them great speakers, but in terms of public life, one commits suicide and the other is executed.
Yeah, it leads Athens to the absolute wrong political choices of the day. Well, that's very interesting, the point you make, that if Light Horse Harry Lee was style over substance, then Robert E. Lee seems to try to be the opposite. It reminds me a bit of John Rockefeller, whose father was a bigamist. He was a literal snake oil salesman and a quack, but a great storyteller. And John Rockefeller was very black and white. He was incredibly hardworking, comported himself as stoically as he possibly could. And there's an interesting similar dynamic here. So I wonder, with you undertaking this biography of Lee, who is a very well-researched figure, but in many ways also a misunderstood figure, what led you to writing a biography about him, and with this scholarship of Lee, what were certain pitfalls that you were trying to avoid?
I was drawn to writing about Robert E. Lee when I finished the book that I wrote on the Battle of Gettysburg, The Last Invasion, in 2013. And I was attracted to the subject of Lee for several reasons. One is curiosity. I really wanted to see what the Civil War looked like through the other end of the telescope. As I say, I'm a Yankee. I'm a Pennsylvanian. And I've lived almost all of my life in Pennsylvania. So I bear the impress of the Union. And I never grew up, as people sometimes do grow up in the South, with his image of Robert E. Lee wearing a halo. That just was never there. So having devoted as much time as I have devoted to writing about Abraham Lincoln, and that's where I've done most of my work, I thought it might be interesting. Let's see what the Civil War looks like through another lens, and what better lens to use than Robert E. Lee. Another thing which drove me to this is what I'm calling difficult biography. There's some biographies that are easy to write because the people that you're writing about are admirable people, and no one questions that. Someone who's writing about Abraham Lincoln, there's not going to be a lot of serious dissent. Abraham Lincoln was a great president, and beyond that, a great individual. You have a portrait of Theodore Roosevelt sitting behind you. People, by and large, are going to look at Theodore Roosevelt and say, here is a man who was the apostle of the strenuous life. A really interesting and in many ways admirable figure. There are some biographies of people like that are not difficult to write. You can admire them without too much hesitation. But there are other people that you scratch your head about. What about Neville Chamberlain? How easy is it to write about Neville Chamberlain? How can you write about Neville Chamberlain without wanting at some point to start screaming and saying, why couldn't you see what Hitler was really about? What did it take? Even someone who is in some respects extremely admirable, like Winston Churchill, you want to ask the question, how could he make as many colossal mistakes as he did make about the Dardanelles, about King Edward VIII, about Gandhi and Indian independence? So there is such a thing as difficult biography. How do you do that? Because if you don't do that, if you just write about people that you decide are admirable, then there are whole ranges of human experience you ignore. All right, how do you write a difficult biography? Especially, how do you write a difficult biography that's made difficult by the fact that the subject commits treason? And again, I'm not throwing the term around lightly. I'm not throwing it to throw mud. I'm throwing it in a very strict legal and constitutional sense, because I cannot look at what Robert E. Lee did and come up with any other definition of what he did except the definition the Constitution deploys for treason. How then do you write a biography of somebody who commits treason, who is a difficult subject? And I thought, all right, this is going to be a challenge. This is going to be a technical hurdle, and I want to see how it should be done. So a third reason then to cap these other two off is that Lee biography has a lot of holes in it. Ulysses Grant has had something like 9 full-dress biographies in the last 35 years, the most recent, of course, being Ron Chernow. And each one of those biographies gets longer and longer. Even William Tecumseh Sherman has had 10 biographies in the last 35 years. But Robert E. Lee, there is a great 4-volume biography of Lee by Douglas Southall Freeman, written in the 1930s. And then there's a handful of interesting smaller studies by Emery Thomas, by Margaret Sanborn. But really, the Mount Everest, the Himalayas almost, of Lee biography is still Freeman. And that was a curious absence, which I thought, all right, let's take this up as a challenge. And there is a reason for it, which is challenging. And that is, if you write about Abraham Lincoln, you can go to the 8 volumes of Lincoln's collected works, and there's everything. If you write about Ulysses Grant, you can go to the 27 volumes of the papers of Ulysses Grant, and there's everything. Lee, no such resource. Lee was a compulsive letter writer, probably wrote something between 6,000 and 8,000 letters in his lifetime. But they are scattered, sometimes just in penny packets, all across in archives all across the country. And I have worked with archives all the way from the Morgan Library in New York to the Huntington Library in San Marino and a lot of points in between. So you find a small collection in Missouri, you find a small collection in Georgia, all over. So the person who wants to essay a biography of Lee immediately has to stop and look at the fact that you're going to spend a lot of time trying to stitch together all of the pieces of the literary quilt of Robert E. Lee. And in fact, the very first thing I had to do in working on this biography was to create what I called a calendar of Lee letters. And by the time I was finished with it, that calendar of Lee letters stretched to 104 single-spaced, single-entry pages. That's a lot of letters. And truth be told, it's not the whole thing, because there's also a lot of Lee letters that are in private hands and that surface on eBay. Someone just sent me a link to a Lee letter that from 1864 that had just surfaced on an auction site. So there is a challenge just in being able to track down and identify the materials in which you'd write the biography. So put all those three things together. And I thought, now this will be different. So let's see what happens. It was the red rag to me. I just couldn't resist. I put my hand in the cookie jar and I went off and wrote this biography of Robert E. Lee.
What were some of the findings that surprised you the most as you're looking through letters or other documents?
One thing which surprises a good deal is the fact that Lee did not particularly enjoy being in the Army. Lee goes to West Point, graduates class of 1829, second in his class. So he's commissioned right away into the elite, the Corps of Engineers. But for the next 30 years while he's in the Corps, hardly a year passes before he doesn't write to somebody saying, well, I'm thinking about leaving the Army. You know, the pay is poor, the promotion is glacial. Maybe I should go into private civil engineering practice. Now, he never does it, but he's always thinking about it. So if you have the idea that Lee is simply nothing but a military figure, here is someone who really did not always enjoy being part of the U.S. Army. And in later years, he would tell a student at Washington College, the biggest mistake of my life was taking a military education, which is a real shocker when you reflect on it. So there's one thing which is a big surprise. Another major surprise is that stint that he puts in the last 5 years of his life as the president of Washington College. When the Civil War ends, Lee, of course, is obviously without employment. So he's casting around. What should he do? He thinks, first of all, about buying some property and turning gentleman farmer, like his older brother, Charles Carter Lee. But then a delegation shows up from Washington College in Lexington, Virginia, which is a small college in the upper end of the Shenandoah, which is almost dead. I mean, the Civil War almost killed the place. And they make this overture to Robert E. Lee, and he accepts, which is a surprise because he had been superintendent of West Point for 3 years. He hated every minute of it. It would bored him out of his mind. He was once offered a teaching position at West Point, turned it down. He said, I'd be terrible in the classroom. I wouldn't know how to communicate with the cadets. But he accepts this job as president of Washington College. One of Lee's former generals writes to the trustees and says, oh, it's great news. You signed up Robert E. Lee as president. He'll be a great figurehead. Don't let him do anything else. Just let him be the figurehead. Robert E. Lee made the trustees into the figurehead. He took charge of Washington College. He took this place, which almost didn't have a pulse. And in 4 years, he's built it up to over 400 students. He's built an endowment of $250,000. I mean, these are substantial numbers in the 19th century. And he's turned into a major success as a fundraiser. Robert E. Lee could really shake the apples out of the tree. He'd make a great development officer today in colleges or universities. Talk about an unsuspected talent. He is an extremely successful college president. And I think in some ways, those last 5 years of his life as president of Washington College may have been the happiest years of his life. Happiest because he is completely in charge of things. He can be as perfection demanding as he wants to be. He's got independence because nobody on that board of trustees is going to disagree with General Lee. and he gets security. Because it's a position no one's ever going to take away from him. Not in their right minds, they aren't. So those last 5 years, the ones that usually get shunted to the side in Lee biographies, actually may have been the ones that gave him the greatest satisfaction of his life. That's a surprise.
Hey everyone, Scott here. One more brief word from our sponsors.
That's very interesting because it sounds like the psychological portrait that you painted earlier, that type of profession suits him very well as opposed to being a general or what he did in his military career. I'd like to talk about the contested points of Lee's life and where you land on it. And for example, for him as a military commander, I mentioned that in the Lost Cause myth, he's celebrated as somebody who aggressively won the war effort in the early years of the Civil War because he was able to marshal his limited resources and use them expertly. He was always willing to go on attack. He harnessed his cavalry with lightning strikes. I credit Stonewall Jackson with that a little bit more. But then others, I've read a number of books by popular historian Edward Bonnekemper, who is very pro-Ulysses S. Grant and says that Grant was much more of a master strategist and knew how to communicate clear orders. And as an overall commander, he was much more successful. Lee was far too aggressive to fight a war of attrition. So he threw men, he threw troops in situations where he should not. He should have just done smaller tactical strikes and then worn out the North. And if Lincoln would have lost in 1864, then the South could have very well won. So that's the other take. But what's your take on, let's say, Lee as a military commander and other contested points in the Lee scholarship field? Where do you land on those?
It's interesting you should mention Ed Bonnekemper because I knew Ed very well. He was a very good friend. With Lee, my take on Lee is that when we try to understand someone as a military commander, as a military leader, there are three basic tasks that you have to use for evaluation. The first question is, what kind of a strategic thinker was Robert E. Lee? Then you want to ask, what kind of a tactical leader was Robert E. Lee? And the third is, what kind of an operational or logistical manager was Robert E. Lee? Those are the three major tasks of a great commander. Lee, I would give 5 stars to in terms of strategic grasp, because that was really his long suit. Lee understood from the very beginning that the South's resources were too limited to sustain a long, drawn-out war. There were people in the South who thought, oh, all we have to do is go on the defensive, just slow the Yankees down, make them take casualties. Lee understood that the North's resources were much, much greater than they were estimating, and that kind of war would only end with the South being ground to powder. He understood that the way to defeat the North was not to expect you were going to defeat it militarily. You were going to have to defeat the North politically. And the way to do that was to carry the campaigns out of the Confederacy, north across the Potomac, into Pennsylvania, either win some kind of battle in Pennsylvania, or at the very least, run loose in Pennsylvania for several months, showing that the Lincoln administration was incapable of defending the North. The impact of that politically on Northern voters would be so negative that when they trooped to the voting booths, they would elect Democratic representatives to Congress and Democratic governors, and the two of them together would put pressure on the Lincoln administration to come to the negotiating table, at which point that would really be effectively the end of the war and the independence of the Confederacy. Lee saw that very clearly. That's why in 1862, he launches his thrust across the Potomac. That is lost because of the lost orders, special orders number 191, copy of Lee's orders that is picked up and found and put into George McClellan's hands. But he's back at it the next year, and that is what brings things to Gettysburg in 1863. He would have done it again. He was planning to do exactly that same thing in 1864, except that Grant jumped off earlier and put Lee on the defensive. Now, Lee really understood the way you were going to win this war was to win it by discouraging the Northern will to win politically. Tactically, he's a somewhat different character to estimate because his philosophy of command, as he expressed it very clearly to the Prussian observer, Justus Scheibert, was he saw his job as bringing his army to the battlefield, and then his immediate subordinates, in this case, Stonewall Jackson, James Longstreet. It was their turn to step in and execute the destruction of the enemy that was in front of them. Logistically speaking, he's probably at his weakest. Not because he didn't understand logistics, but because logistics is the place where you interface most dramatically with the civilian sector, with the political side of things. Logistics is about supply. It's about obtaining reliable sources and streams of supply. The Confederate government was poorly organized for that, but Lee was unwilling to challenge civilian authority, even when it meant that the soldiers of his army would very likely go without shoes, go without uniforms, go without food. He had learned very early on in his career, don't mess with the politicians. Any soldier who attempts to put his foot into the river of politics will very quickly find himself washed out to sea. He saw that in the case of his first mentor, Charles Grayshot, the chief of the Corps of Engineers, and he saw it in Mexico with another person who's really served as a kind of surrogate father, and that was Winfield Scott. That makes Lee very dicey about confronting the civilian sector, and it means that logistically speaking, his army is more often than not going to go a-begging. So Top Rank as a strategist, it's less clear what we see in Lee as a field tactician. And probably the weakest part is the logistical because of his aversion to putting his hand into the political mess that was all around him in Virginia.
That's an interesting point. And to Lee's credit, to be a successful logistician leading the Confederacy, I mean, you'd have to be a genius on the level of a Frederick the Great or Otto von Bismarck or somebody very Prussian to handle that when you have such limited resources. So, but you're the expert on this. I mean, heck, you wrote the book. So could somebody more, was he simply dealt too bad of a losing hand, or could a better, a more Prussian logistician have handled it?
Well, I think someone who was more aware, more willing to deal with the political side than Lee would. Lee had an almost pathological aversion to dealing with politicians. For one thing, he didn't think very highly of Confederate politicians. He thought that most of the Confederate political sector was weak of will. They expected a cheap victory that wouldn't cost them anything. They weren't willing to make the sacrifices. All through the war, Lee is complaining. He says to his son at one point in the war that the Confederate Congress does nothing but spend its whole day talking and debating, chewing tobacco, and eating peanuts. He didn't mean that any of that as a compliment. And on the road to Appomattox, he makes the comment to William Nelson Pendleton, "This is the way I always knew it was going to turn out. I always knew the North was going to win this war." And he blames that on Southerners' lack of willingness to make the sacrifices that they need to make. Now, could Robert E. Lee have been the kind of figure that demanded those sacrifices? Not when you measure his aversion to politics. He just was unwilling to confront political needs that way. In that respect, he's different from Grant. Grant has two very good political antennae, and they are well-tuned to developments in politics in the North. And that is especially true of his relationship with Abraham Lincoln. He has a very good, a very effective relationship with Lincoln as president, and they make a tremendous partnership. It's one of the great partnerships of American history. But Grant was willing to do that, and he had good natural political senses. He didn't have that aversion that Lee had, and not having that aversion to politics turned out to be a genuine plus for Grant because it meant that Lincoln would basically give Grant anything he asked for.
And that brings up another great Ed Bonnekemper book, Lincoln and Grant, the Westerners Who Won the Civil War. So he has a lot to contribute to this conversation. Well, I mean, there's so much to explore here with Lee, but I suppose you've plumbed the depths of his paradoxes and complexities and noted at the beginning that you're looking at a historical figure who, by constitutional definition, committed treason. And as I've explored explored this question of treason and what does it mean. Southern sympathizers and many of the Confederates themselves claimed, well, we're simply following in the steps of the Founding Fathers. They too, had the British won, would have all been hanged for committing treason. But they saw that according to the social compact that exists between the governed and those who rule them, that if you behave in a tyrannical fashion, then you have lost the consent of the governed. And that's what Southerners believed, how they were being ruled. So they said that we're just simply following similar steps. Or it's what I've read about those who give intelligence, who double-cross their own governments and give intelligence and secrets to enemy governments because spies on the other side might recruit them by convincing them that, well, you're not betraying your country, you're betraying your elected leaders, but your elected leaders are fools, they're not doing your country justice, you're actually serving the higher good by betraying these people here who don't understand the higher good the way you do. So, hey, it's okay to give us a little bit of that good old-fashioned intelligence and nuclear launch codes. Why not? Come on, we're pals here. So, yeah, with these different types of narratives and justifications of Lee's life and all the different complexities, and I'm not arguing for the Confederates or the Founding Fathers. I'm not saying that. I'm just restating the argument. So what do you make of the paradoxes of Lee's life, and what do you hope that readers take away from your book?
Well, the first thing I'd say is that there's a great deal of political assertion coming from the apostles of the lost cause about the secession of the Confederacy being somehow lawful. Well, there was no body of legal scholarship that was willing to make that argument seriously before the Civil War. The Constitution contains no reversion clause. Now, the Constitution doesn't even describe a mechanism for voluntary secession by the states. And the Constitution describes the mechanism for amending the Constitution. It describes in detail the mechanism for the Electoral College. That's the single biggest thing in the Constitution. There's a description of the mechanism for calling a convention of the states. And, you know, there's many other things as well. But there's not a breath of description of a mechanism for secession. So if you consider the Constitution in terms of the original intent of the founders, all the evidence is that the founders believed they were creating a permanent union. I mean, the whole purpose of convening the Constitutional Convention in 1787 was to head off the potential dismemberment of the Union and the secession of parts of the Union. I mean, there were some parts of the American Union in between the time of the Treaty of Paris in 1783 and the Constitutional Convention in 87, when some areas were actually advocating opening negotiations for reunion with Great Britain. Vermont was talking, Vermont's not part of the American Union yet, but it is talking about negotiations with the British Empire for some kind of reconstitution that way. There were even some small parts of the United States which were advocating for that. The whole purpose of the Constitution was to create a more permanent union, not to create mechanisms for dismembering it. And I think of how Michael Klarman, in his book on the creation of the Constitution, a great book, Klarman says the views of the delegates in the convention were, as he put it, stunningly nationalistic. So the notion that somehow the Confederacy is acting in the spirit of the revolutionaries, the spirit of the founders, this is about as far as you can get from anything that looks like predictable truth. Now, there was uncertainty about the locus of citizenship. That's because the Constitution talks about citizenship in five places. And in those five places, it refers alternately to state citizenship and national citizenship, and does it without specifying which was supposed to have the preeminence. We didn't settle that until the 14th Amendment. But that doesn't do much for explaining or excusing Lee, because the oath that Robert Lee took upon his commissioning in 1829 was explicitly to the United States. It was an oath that had been established in the first congressional legislation on the military forces of the United States in 1790. It was still in use at the outbreak of the Civil War. It's an oath of loyalty to the United States, not to the states of the Union. That's the first thing. In fact, Lee himself did not regard Virginia as possessing a right to secession. He makes that in his own comments. Lee insists that, this is in a letter he writes to one of his Carter relatives in January of 1861. He says, secession is revolution. There's no constitutional mechanism for secession. Secession simply is outright revolution. It's a radical break with the Constitution. And it's going to be followed, he says, by war, and can't be otherwise. So even Robert E. Lee was not under any illusions that somehow what the Confederacy was doing was something that the founders would have sanctioned in the Constitution. The United States never was some kind of voluntary federation of states like the UN. The Constitution's very explicit when it calls itself the supreme law of the land. And the enumerated rights of the states, this is what you find in Article 1, Section 9 and Section 10. The rights of the states articulated in the Constitution don't include any functions that suggest some kind of sovereignty equal with the national government. It's just not there. This is an illusion. And people afterwards wanted to impute that illusion to Robert E. Lee. Now, the funny thing is that Robert E. Lee will, in time, adopt some of that rhetoric, but he will adopt it after the war, mostly as a justification for his own decision and to hold at bay the accusations and demands about treason. But if you take Lee before the war and right up to the beginning of the war, there's no sense in which he thinks that secession has any legitimacy in and of itself. Secession is simply nothing but revolution. All right, if you're going to have a revolution, well, like all revolutionaries, you take your chances. But you don't necessarily create something which has legal substance or constitutional substance. Now, the funny thing is that the decades after the Civil War really become the golden age of state rights. Now, the Civil War does not, as some people have tried to argue, and it passes my understanding how this argument can be made to get up and walk. The Civil War does not create some kind of massive centralized federal government. It doesn't create it in budgetary terms. It doesn't create it in terms of federal bureaucracy. It doesn't create it in terms of federal law or of judicial review of federal law. That really doesn't begin to happen until we move into the 20th century and the advent of progressivism and the presidency of Woodrow Wilson. So trying to enlist Robert E. Lee as some kind of paladin of a lost cause is, to my mind, itself a kind of lost cause, and just misses the man himself by a considerable distance.
Well, as listeners know, I like looking into the lives of these ambiguous figures because we see the ambiguity in our own hearts. And it's great to study the lives of William Wilberforce or Adolf Hitler, but somebody who's so unequivocally good or bad can be a little bit vanilla. So someone like Lee is a good antidote to this. And for listeners who want to check out your book, the name of it is Robert E. Lee, A Life. Alan, thank you for joining us.
Scott, it's been a pleasure to talk to you, and I hope we have an opportunity to do so again soon.
All right, that is all for today. If you'd like to see show notes for this episode and all my other episodes, go to ParthenonPodcast.com. That's the name of the podcast network that this show is a part of, along with other great history shows like Steve Guerra's Beyond the Big Screen and History of the Papacy, James Early's Key Battles of American History, and other shows as well. If you'd like to support this show, there are two easy ways to do so. The first is to subscribe to History Unplugged on the podcast player of your choice and leave a review. The second thing is to join the show's membership program. It's on Patreon, and if you go to patreon.com/unplugged and join it, as a member, you'll get completely ad-free episodes of the show's entire back catalog, which is 600 episodes and growing. Just go to patreon.com/unplugged. Thanks for listening, and I'll see you next time.